All right, we're recording now. Let me just say one thing about the Chibisarashba that I didn't discuss last time. If you saw that. What's this, Noah?
Benjamin Porat?
No, different guy. Different guy. That's not, you know, that's not him, right?
Yeah, I found his bio.
Yeah, you gotta look. He's at, I think, Bar Ilan or something. Yeah, there you go. Then. Wait, hold on a second. Yeah? All right.
He has a piece on
my kids are officially on winter break, so you might hear some bloodshed outside my door. All right. One comment on this really interesting Chibisarashba that we didn't get to last time. Here we go. Let me share my screen. Did anybody get a chance to see this one on the renter? So the renter is this Chilek Vav Simon Kufiyat Aleph Shalta. Okay, so the Rashba here in Vav Kufiyat Aleph talks about a case of Reuven who lent his house to Shimon, and they did some sort of kinyan on the borrowing, on the Sheila. Anybody, so the facts of the case are long and complicated. Did anybody get a chance to read through this? Okay, so Noah, you want to tell us very quickly how the Shoel Shimon, like, it sounds like he sublet it to somebody else. Is that right?
Yeah, basically, the case is that Reuven lent the house to Shimon, but then, and they did like a kinyan on it, but then Shimon lent it to his son Yehuda, who made improvements. Then Reuven tries to get the house back and protests against the improvements. And yeah,
I think that's right. And it's complicated also because the house was destroyed in the process, right? It sounds like Liyamim Nafal Abayis V'Neras Kol Abinyan.
Right.
Which is an added wrinkle here. But the simple facts of the case that are relevant for us are Reuven lends the Bayis to Shimon. Shimon sublends it to Yehuda, his son. Yehuda makes a bunch of improvements. And now they want to charge Reuven, the landlord, for the improvements to the house. Right? Pretty straightforward. Now, the whole beginning part of the tshuva is whether Shimon had a right to lend it out to Yehuda. Very interesting Sheila question. So we'll come back to this tshuva Sarashba when we talk about Shoel, which is coming up around the corner. See, I guess like the common thread between our limud is like a tshuva Sarashba pulling us from one topic to the next topic. We're just following the Rashba on these wild goose chases. So we'll talk about the Shoel and, you know, it's very interesting, you know, Stam Sheila, that he is like a Bailim and there's Konami Yado, so he could do whatever he wants with the bias. We'll talk about that. At the end here, when he talks about the improvements, what does the Rashba say? Ulinyan Habinyan Shabanabo Yehuda. So take it away, Noah.
So Ulinyan Habinyan Shabanabo Yehuda, Kolshep Savach Ruvain, Vigila Bedaito, Sheino Chafetzbo, Eno Chayavlo, right? As long as Ruvain demonstrates that he doesn't want the additions to the house or the improvements to the house, then he's not obligated.
Exactly.
But Yehuda can still say Eitzai v'avanani notel and take back the materials.
Yeah. So this is pretty standard. This is pretty standard from what we've seen. If there's some ex post gilei das kol shetzaveach Reuven the gila b'dayto sheino chafetzbo. This was interesting here is that this seems to be, sounds like objectively there was probably increased the market value. Just there's a subjective gilei das from the landlord that he didn't benefit, and that's enough to defeat the Yored's claim for compensation. of course, he says, the Yorid could recover Eitzai Vavanyani Noto, which seems pretty standard, like a standard view in the Rishonim. I would just point out that, remember, just to recall the Radvaz, who said in a case of Lichatchila Macha, the Yorid might forfeit his materials even. But I think in this kind of subjective Gilui Das case, it's reasonable to say that everybody would agree the Yorid could take back his materials, right? And I think the idea is that, you know, he could take back his materials because that undoes the unjust enrichment problem. If the whole problem is that, like, the Balabai shouldn't be nene from the materials and the pool of the poel of the Yorid, once it's reversed, there's really no concern that somebody's benefiting from somebody else's labor anymore. So you might think that's almost as good as paying compensation for it. Noah, you were going to say something, and then Adin has a hand.
Yeah, also the Rashba says, even in the case of prospective mecha'a, that you still can't, that the Yorid can still take the Eitzim Vavanim back.
That's right, in that other tshuva. Right? In the one before this, in Dalid, Nun Dalid. Blah, blah, blah. That's right. Oh, wait, we have Shua joining. Okay, good. Okay, we have Adin and then Zachariah with hands.
The point that we were making at the end, especially like how to, I don't know if it's a literal textual translation of the Rashba's conclusion, but I think it links well to what I was thinking about a lot while reading Korat, which is the, is Reuven's Gilui Da'as just a technical patur from being Mechaev, or is this Gilui Da'as a proof that no Hana'a has happened, that we can only define something as Hana'a if it's accepted or not, or if it's not not rejected, but a rejection of the improvement defines the improvement as one of no Hana'a, and therefore there's no, and therefore if there's no Hana'a, there can be nothing to pay for.
Yeah, my inclination is the latter. It's almost like, look, the Yorid gets the lesser of the Shevach or the costs. Here the Shevach is zero, given the Balabai's preferences.
But we're gonna apply that standard even when there's a clear and absolute, like you said, like shoveling the driveway, you could argue, okay, it'll melt or something, but like could we like realistically apply that standard when, I know, the Kelly Blue Book value has like a car with an old engine is worth 10,000, and now with this I have proof that this car with this new engine sells for an additional 2,000 or something like that. Can we still define that as non-Hana'a?
Yeah, so I think the argument is, this is where it gets complicated. You would say, look, and the Rishonim say this, right? If there's a ex post facto Gilui Das to Nichole, if this guy puts his car on the market, you know, a year, like a few months after the engine's replaced, and he recovers like the added value, we'll say, oh, it's a Gilui Das to Nichole. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's claiming that like it's low Nichole, but Lamaisa, you went ahead and sold it now. So I think we would like hold him liable for that differential. We would say that's like a Gilui Das to Nichole. But if you never had an interest in selling the car, he just likes the car sitting in his driveway because it looks good, and the marginal difference in the engine has no meaning to him because he likes driving his Porsche rather than the whatever car that was improved, then I think, yeah, it's a good argument, right? He's saying that I have no interest in this thing.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I'm thinking like you're making a good point that property, like prospective value is not a tangible benefit. Necessarily a tangible benefit that I can point to right now.
That's right. It really depends what's being done with the thing and how you're going to reap the benefit from it.
Got it.
Okay, right. Zachariah.
Yeah, I had a are about the Rashba, which I think kind of supports this reading. He slips in at the end of the Chidushi Rashba piece that, yes, even if the, I think it's there, if not in one of the Shutta. It's in the Shut following that. Even if there's a prospective macha, if the Baal Hasadeh does the Gilui Das, he starts fencing it in, he still has to pay. He can be locked in and being hired to pay, which I think is not obvious. I think if you're viewing this as like, yeah, just like, you know, just a prospective lo nichale, and that's still subject to change. then okay, that makes a lot of sense. If you view it as more fundamental, like right to exclude, like I've put my foot down, you have no rishus to be here, then it might be that the transaction's over and it's not about my subjective fundamental.
100%. 100%. See, like, I agree with you 1,000%. The fact that the Rashba and this Tshuva, in Dalid and in Dalid, says, oh, a prospective macha defeats the Yorid's claim unless there's an after the fact Gilei Das to Nichalei. That shows that this is all just about getting into the Baal HaBayis' mind. Did he benefit? Did he not benefit? It's not about, like, well, what authority does he have to control what's done in his property? I agree. And the Radvaz, who had the strongest view, I think, you know, like, because he said that the Yorid can't even take his Eitzim Ba'avanim in a case where there's a prospective Macha. You know, to me, it sounds like the Radvaz might be in for the stronger claim, which is once you're Mocha, you put up the property, you put up walls on your property. It's like almost a Baal Paratz thing, like by default, like property boundaries and Halacha are not that strong. But like you have the right to erect normative fences.
He and, called it. He called it an act. He called the right to exclude an active right, which you've
that's a, enforced. That's right. Yeah. Well. Right. So. Well. Exactly. So if you erect a normative fence, then that makes all boundary crossings illegitimate, and maybe even if there's ex post facto nichale, the Yorid would still not be able to recover on that theory.
Can I just say that I find the Radbaz's reasoning like almost easy. Like I don't, he's got this svara, what is it? Lav kol kamine lachovis chavero bal korcho, right? So that seems to underdetermine things. You're not creating a chov, like that under, that factor underdetermines the right, the loss of the right to reclamation. Like,
yeah. We had this issue at the end of last Chabura, I think, right? We were going back and forth on this. I agree with you. Yeah. I think Noah had something to say about it then, right, Noah?
Oh, yeah. I might have left a minute or, oh, no, I didn't. Oh, maybe I just forgot. Anyway, yeah, it's just like, I mean, it's plausible that you lose the right to reclamation. I mean, we have seen in this sugya that the, although it's weird, there's a tension. On the one hand, if the Baal says no, it's staying here, plausibly that means he wants to make a kinyan on it and therefore would owe you compensation. My best thought here is that, like, the Radbaz is that, like, the violation, the kind of the trespass against the Baal HaBayis is, you know, kind of protest, is you know, you get a pen, like there's some kind of penalty for it,
that's right,
or something like that. That's an explanatory demand the Radbaz would have to incur.
But yeah,
probably the best.
You could also say,
go ahead again.
You could also, like, the Radvaz, I think it's interesting that he doesn't make Cole's point or the suggestion that I'm about to make, which is, you said that if there's a prospective macha, then, like, the only reason I'm giving, like, the only thing I could be giving it to you as is b'matana. Like, I can't claim any sort of expected, like expected return on investment or anything, or invested amount of time. Like, okay, so if I know you don't want me to do it and I choose to do it anyway, like, I'm, it's like I'm dropping.
I actually like that. I like what Adin just said better than what I just said, that basically, if you're, yeah, because a macha, one way to
sure, read. Sure, this is kind of what Noah was saying, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't actually left early. But that, yeah, yeah. Exactly what Noah was suggesting last time. Baruch Shekivantem, you know, it's the same.
He doesn't make that, like what Cole was saying is correct, that like he's citing the wrong precedent here. Like,
anyway, I like this matana idea.
Yeah, it's like once, if you trespass when you know the Baal HaBayis is mocha, we're going to impute das of matana to your action, right? That's the argument. I think that makes a lot of sense here. And that's right, because the Baal HaBayis has the right to erect a normative fence around his property. He just has to proactively be mocha,
right,
to establish that. Okay, I just want to mention one other makar here. This Yad Arman Baba Basra, also on the Makif and Nikaf Sugya, he has a similar formulation to that Shuvas Arashba that Zacharia drew our attention to. He says, prospective macha works. He says, "Igali adaite me kara dilo nichale lo mechayv lo meisev le lefi mashagadar." This is when somebody's building a wall around your property. If you're megala das in advance, you don't have to pay the guy. And then he says, "Ihaven megala daita me kara dilo avan nichale b'hai binyan b'hai netios." Now discussing the Yorid case, lo haven mechayvin on le lo mili. Ad de megala adaite de nichale. I guess it sounds like until there's some later gilui das that it is nichale. You see that? But I guess this is a little different from a macha, right? You might say macha is different from just an ex ante gilui das that it's lo nichale. You could go from right. So if you originally just a megala das is lo nichale, of course you could change your mind to nichale. That might be different from just being mocha and not wanting somebody there. Cole, are you you stuck in a pretzel or something?
I just come back from a run, so I'm stretching.
Great. You know, stretch out and run. Pull a hamstring or something. One of the perks of Zoom, right?
Of what? Oh, yeah. I don't have to get dressed for sheer.
I thought Shua only had that license.
Yeah, well, that's like Shua's default. I'm usually in business casual. So.
All right, good. Okay, so that's what I wanted to just cover from that discussion. Was everyone able to access the Shomrim source sheet? Okay, I emailed it out. Hopefully everyone has access to it. I'm going to add a few more Makoros there, and we'll start with Shomrim on Tuesday. So now I want to discuss the Parat piece.
Sorry, this is not just an admin question, but I feel like before Parat.
Sure.
If I forward that Google Doc to someone, will then they have access? Is that how does that work?
Yeah, I made the sharing settings so that anybody with the link could access it.
Okay, cool. And like it will continue to update itself?
Yeah. But if you want me to include somebody directly, I could just include them.
All right, cool. Maybe I'll have a chavrusa for Shomrim. Let's get excited.
That's great. You recruited Eitan or?
I recruited Isaac. I also recruited Eitan, so they might have to fight it out. But
okay, great.
Isaac is still mad at me because I told him I wouldn't take lectures about morality from somebody who accepted paychecks from Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, it might be a sensitive issue.
You know, he and I will make peace. I promise.
Okay, good. Okay, so Shomrim is the agenda for Tuesday. I'm going to update this source sheet. I'll send out a PDF of that Rebbe Chimtzin shiur. It's actually a nice shiur that I think has some interesting ideas. We may not agree with all of them, but definitely worth discussing most of the points in that little shiur I'll send around. Okay, so let's talk about Parat. Here's the article. There are a few ways to do this. Let me just, I want to make a few general comments. So pull up in my notes here. I think this is a very worthwhile exercise. Okay, hold on one second. I think Noam wants to say hi for one second. So Noam's going to come say hi to everyone. Oops. Noam, come say hi. Let's say hi to everyone.
Say what?
Ayel, you
want to
say hi?
Say hi. I want to watch.
Say hi to everyone. You say hi. Here's anything you want to share with everyone? Thought? Nothing? Want to tell them why you're home today? Why are you home? No. Kazav? Okay. What? Has it winter break? Very exciting. Okay.
Hey, watch Abba.
Yeah, can I'm putting
my number? Go
okay, I get to say hi. Say hi.
Fine, then okay.
Say hi.
Abba, can I watch?
Yeah, I'll say hi to everyone else. Y'all, anything you want to share?
Abba.
No?
No? Okay. Abba, can I watch?
I think Ayel's going to be in charge of color by numbering with you.
Yay! Abba, I
want to watch. In charge.
I'm not watching.
Yeah. All right. That was the entertainment for the day. Okay. Parad piece. So I think the exercise is really interesting to try to bring out the differences or explicate the differences between Jewish law and American law. I think the payoff is that you see what's like distinctive about the halacha's approach to this question. And contrasting it with the American law is a nice way of teasing out what's distinct. Do any of you have broad thoughts on just the piece before we get into the substance of the analysis? Anybody have just overall thoughts? So let's get into the substance, and then we could raise. Shua, did you have a chance to read it?
I skimmed it. I'll be honest. It was kind of like Mishmatchelo Yom V'Lalila, but I did think that the framing was helpful. I think that there's probably a lot that we can do kind of here to take apart the different claims. But I think the framing of like the kind of like global relationship to someone's property as opposed to kind of like the individual right to exclude is like trivial, but very conceptually helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a little torn about that, which we'll see when we get into the substance of the piece. I think the article is set up to bring out this difference in the conception of property between the two systems, right? And the main claim you could see here on page 148, and then I'll show you, we'll get back to Shua's point, is...
You mind, you're only sharing the Google Doc when switching the share to the...
Oh, okay, sorry about that. Good point. How's this? Okay. Good. So you can see here on page 148, he says the main claim is there's a distinct conception of ownership between the two systems. While Americans focus on an absolute notion of private ownership, okay, on this idea of total exclusion, exclusivity, Jewish law sources espouse a qualified version of ownership and exclusivity. So his main thesis is that the notion of exclusivity and private property is different between the systems. In the American system, like a private property owner is considered to have exclusive control, exclusive authority. And halacha, it's much more qualified. That's like his main thesis. It's about the degree of exclusivity that you have in your property. Now, I think he has a good job here laying this out. On page 151, he says that in the American conception, we're going to assume that every uninvited activity is illegitimate, even if the owner is not damaged. So part of property exclusivity is exclusion. So we're going to assume that any unauthorized boundary incursion is going to be an illegitimate act. That's just the presumption under the American conception of exclusivity. Okay. And what he does here is he pumps these theories of right to exclude. You can see here on the bottom of 151, he cites Blackstone, that property is the sole and despotic dominion which one man has over external things in the world, in the total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe. Very famous quote from Blackstone. I think we encountered this earlier in the year. And he says, oh, that's like the Anglo-American conception. He quotes Merrill, Thomas Merrill, who says, warning, this quote makes zero sense, just a reminder. Merrill says, give somebody the right to exclude from a valued resource and you give them property, deny someone exclusion right and they do not have property. This is a dubious claim that just like, oh, like the essence of property is the ability to exclude people, right? So you give somebody the right to exclude and they have property, take away the right to exclude and you don't have property. We don't have to get into this analysis, but the intuition is supposed to be that like the essence of property is the ability to exclude people, okay? So he pumps up these notions of American law having absolute control. On the bottom of page 152, he says, part of this is that you have a right to exclude arbitrarily with no objective justification for the exclusion. you don't have to explain why you're keeping somebody out. It's just part of your property right that you could say who enters and who's forced to wait outside. Okay. And he says, by contrast, let me just make one other point here. Footnote 21. Yeah. I think footnote 21 is important. Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question to figure out how much this characterization, how accurate this characterization of the American side of things is, whether it's this exclusion heavy. Footnote 21 concedes that it's a bit of a lopsided portrayal of the Anglo-American view. But that doesn't really affect our, unless you're interested in that per se, it doesn't affect halakhic analysis. In footnote 21, he points out, I just thought this was interesting, that in many states in the US, it used to be that they would require a landowner who didn't want his neighbor's roving cattle to roam on his property to enclose his land with a fence. Meaning it puts the burden on a landowner. Like if you don't want to be a nizak al yedei shein v'rego, you have to put up a wall. Pretty sure there's like a discussion in Bava Kamma about this. Zechariah, there is, right?
Yeah, I was just about to bring that up.
Where's that Gemara? It's but yeah, there's an explicit discussion about this, right? It's like Alamat.
I thought the Shaker Regular Shoes Tanizak is Chayev.
Yeah, you're only Chayev for Shaker Regular versus Anizak, right? But there's some question whether like the Nizak has to take some precautions against it. But either way, Parad acknowledges that this puts some pressure on his claim, right? That you have to do something before you could exercise your property right. And then he quotes Larissa Katz's argument, which we'll talk about. She totally disagrees with his characterization of American law. She thinks that even in the American law, even in the common law, like the real idea is that somebody can't do something to your property that's going to block or undermine the agenda that you set for your property, but just like a harmless trespass or a harmless use of your property that doesn't interfere with the owner's agenda for the property would be totally kosher.
Isn't that completely circular?
What do you mean, Cole?
Is it harm defined on her theory as agenda setting?
I'm not sure if she defines harm that way or she thinks
or
that
or whatever.
So I wouldn't focus on harm because like for Merrill
or whatever, something actionable.
Well, for that's the point. For the view that Porat's putting forward,
then she hasn't told us anything.
Any incursion across the boundary, across the border, is considered wrongful without the owner's authorization.
Right.
And the Larissa Katz theory, which he footnotes, no, like the real point of the common law is that any action that undermines the owner's agenda for the property.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's, and like she explicitly talks about like a harmless trespass. And she talks about all these laws, like in Sweden, for example, it's totally kosher to walk through somebody's field if you're not intruding on their privacy or affecting the way they're able to harvest it.
Okay.
Fine. All right. So that's a little bit of the background. Now on page 153 here, he says that Jewish law has a different conception. It has a qualified version of ownership and a qualified version of the right to exclude. He thinks that in Jewish law, you can't arbitrarily exclude somebody from your property. You have to have some logical reason, he says, such as an economically driven exclusion. So like, there has to be some justification for why you're not letting somebody onto your property.
Does he think there's no such thing as trespass in halacha?
He admits later that like you have the right to activate your, like in his footnote, he's like, the Mordechai, like for his approach, the Mordechai that he footnotes and be like, there is a Mordechai that says this, but it's not mainstream. We're like,
yeah. That's like, very much like he frames the thing around the narrative that he's trying to spin 100%.
I mean, he does have like a point about Kofanami, the stone, that's like related to this, like fairly Like that is fairly on point, right? Like the conception of Kofinomi-less Gnome as this kind of like meta principle that says like do better than just arbitrary.
True. That is true. So I think as Shua said before, like the issue really is what's the rule, what's the exception? This is just a methodologically difficult thing to do, right? So he's saying, well, the mainstream Jewish law, kind of you get this thing. And she was saying, yeah, you have Midas Tom and Yored and Zenon of Zelo Chaser. But then as you point out, well, if you have a Mordechai who says, if you have a Radvaz who says you can be Mocha in advance and get the same result of American law, then you have a Mordechai who says in Zenon of Zelo Chaser that, of course, L'chatchila, if you tell the guy he can't be there, then he has to pay rent if he's there, even if it's Zelo Chaser. Does that change like the fundamental conception of the halachic side of things, right? So I'm totally sympathetic to that conception. I'm totally sympathetic to that view that, I'm a little skeptical about the ability to talk in broad strokes about like the Jewish conception without talking about the particular Shita's conception. So like, yeah, maybe the Mordechai and the Radvaz just have a totally different conception of halachic property than, say, like the Rishonim who think the Yored is always going to collect Tashlumen.
I was impressed with how qualified he was in addressing this point of yours. Like he does recognize that and qualifies his arguments with
that. Don't be impressed. That just means he doesn't have a theory.
And qualifies his arguments, like, you know, by saying that there are, like, you know, there are a lot of voices in Jewish law, you know.
Yeah. But the question is, could you acknowledge that and still make this, like, you know, oh, here's, like, the Jewish view versus the American view? And
Yeah.
You know, it's not unique to our sugya, right? It's people do this all the time, right? It's like here's the Jewish view on things. And the question coherent to always talk about a consistent Jewish position when like some of the Shitas are Kirchok Mizrach Mimara, right?
I wasn't as troubled. I think I agree with Noah that I wasn't as troubled by like, okay, anything like this is always going to like by its nature is going to have to reach a little further than it like probably can. I think like as something he didn't, I wasn't at least either I missed it or I wasn't convinced by his within his conception of what the Jewish view is. The idea of a prospective macha makes very, very little sense. Like that he didn't explain like, okay, so if it's all arevus and it's all like economic efficiency or whatever you say, then why is it that I don't have the, like, why isn't the Mordechai right? Why doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like that okay. I found is like the biggest good challenge.
Good. So yes, yeah, so again, I think he's raising, as he points out, a slightly different point. I've been saying, forget about like the outlying she does. I forget about like the question of what do we take to be the mainstream Jewish view versus like the quirky Mordechai and Zenon of Zelo Chaser. It's that the idea is rather that once you get over all the exceptions, it's not clear, like even the mainstream exceptions, right? So like let's say everybody agrees that prospective macha blocks the Yored's claim for compensation. Does that still support the fundamental conceptual distinction between Jewish property and American property that Peratt's advocating, right, Adin?
Yeah, like the idea of like his own theory doesn't if you take it as a given that you can have like that you can have a prospective macha, then like it does a decent job at explaining the two differences. But like what I said in the chat of like, oh, clearly like this is all like what's the exact quote that I put in, like the Dr. Grach, like he obviously doesn't have a raya,
right? Obviously.
The difference between the two competing understandings is undoubtedly rooted in a much broader difference that relates to the general socioeconomic ethos.
Oh, we're gonna get to that. Yeah, let's get to that in a second. I want to talk specifically about that point, but I think your methodological point is right on target. This happens in all sorts of cases. So for example, you know, you have people say this thing about Davar Shelo B'Liolam and Davar Shuso. I think I was once talking to Chaim Seiman about this. He's like, oh, you know, the fact that Jewish law doesn't allow you to transact in all these Davar Shelo B'Liolam, Zainab Rishuso, Davar Shimbo Mamish things, that's because, like, you see what happens with, like, the credit default crisis when people are buying all these subprime mortgages. They don't even know what they're buying. Like, the whole economy just, you know, could fall through because no one knows, like, the actual entitlements that they have and what their true value is. It's an interesting point. But the problem is then, like, if you think that Minhug and, like, Situmta will just incorporate all those things, then it's hard to okay, you have an interesting theory for why Debrecen, but then why recognize it Al-Yedei Minhug? Like, the whole point is that it shouldn't be recognized at all. Shula, you have a thought on this, or?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't think that you even need that. I don't think you need that question to attack the theory, but I agree that it's a valid question.
All right. So you have a similar point here, right? I mean, he's drawing out this difference, but then if the Machla could get you to the same place that American law is, how significant then is the difference between the systems, or the difference in the theory of property? Okay, so let's get to the point that Adin was raising here at the bottom, the substantive claim. He says here, this is on page 153. So he says that this approach, the Jewish approach, introduces a more toned down, moderate characteristic of sharing into the concept of ownership. Okay. So there's something about, like, not being able to exclude people, that just this idea of sharing. He says that in Jewish law, you need to do something active in order to block people from entering your property. Whereas in American law, it's automatic, right? It's like a passive right that you automatically have. And then he says here in the bottom of 154, I take this to be probably the core of the thesis, as Adin points out. And I want to know what you think about this. I know Cole is going to go crazy over the word choice here. He says, the difference between the two competing understandings of the idea of property is undoubtedly rooted in a much broader difference that relates to the general socioeconomic ethos of their respective societies. The language of Jewish law consists of values that belong to the semantic field of brotherhood. I'm laughing about semantic field. Like, who's, like, what does that mean? Like, what's a
tenure somewhere?
What?
Did I have tenure somewhere?
Yeah, I think I have Hebrew U, but he's Israeli.
The moron.
Because of the semantic field usage?
You really get tenure in the humanities. It's the humanities in the West are really astonishing. You're bechezkas an idiot if you're getting tenure in the humanities at a Western university, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway.
Pulls on the attack these days. It's it must be the Srugi, the resurrected Srugi. I'm just kidding, Cole. So the article here says that the difference is explained by this semantic field of brotherhood, friendship, collective solidarity, and interpersonal responsibility, while emphasizing the role of community. What do you make of this? You find this compelling? What do you think? And look what he footnotes.
Footnotes the Dvar Torah you heard in
Shul that week. Losamod Adam Reyecha. And he says that these implications are found in the concept of private property, which contains the characteristic of sharing. He says this is in contrast to the American approach.
This is poorly articulated, but not totally wrong.
Okay, so let's
hear it. The truth is I agree with Shua.
So let's hear Shua. So my question is, I'll say my question. So the American side is more about independence, negative liberty, entrepreneurship, self-reliance. My question is, first of all, does the evidence sustain this distinction that it's really like achva, reyacha, it's those principles at work? Second of all, to me, it's a little surprising to, like, these dinim are often invoked in halacha in particular areas, hashavas aveda, sometimes in nezikin, ki yagov, like, shor achicha, ki gach shorish, Shoriehu. And like those areas definitely seem to be governed to some extent by conceptions of achicha or reyacha. It seems to me a chiddush to say that like these rules of choshen mishpat, of bailus and karka and yored, are undergirded by conceptions of achicha. In a footnote, I think he recognizes this. In this footnote here, this interesting one, in footnote 29, he says, an additional question I hope to deal with in a different paper is whether the distinctive features of Jewish property law apply universally or only apply between members of the Jewish community. That's like a really interesting self-aware point. He's saying, well, wow, if it's really achicha and reyacha, maybe the whole din of yored is only between two Jews, right? Our Gemara doesn't tell us that there should be a difference between a yored who's Jewish or a yored who's not Jewish, right? Which is
it does make the kind of
one second. By the way, the Chazon Ish in that discussion of Tosfos about Reishis Kitzirchem, right, was explicitly addressing the concern of Kitzir Nachri. Right, if the bailus of Eretz Yisrael was owned by Jews, Tosos viewed the inhabitants of Israel as a yored, which made the produce Kitzir Nachri. So that just seems to be an interesting case where it's explicitly Jew, non-Jew. But yeah, let's hear some thoughts on this before we go on. Gabe, you have some thoughts?
Yeah, this is just zooming out for 1 second, but I think there's your discomfort with this relates to your take on the Masna Mashikasa Batora questions and whether it's viable or whether it's morally neutral to supplant Choshen Mishpat Halachos with the secular system of law. So you seem, I think you were arguing that that's something we could sort of rightfully do, that Choshen Mishpat is just another alternative legal system. But if you understand...
I didn't say it's just another. Oftentimes it sets up as the default rules. Borrow Cole's phrase of the sleeping sovereign. I didn't just say it's just another legal system. I said, but what's possible in the system is that Kol Tanai Sheva Mamon could override it, right?
Right. So I'm sympathetic to a reading which seeks to determine or mine our Choshen Mishpat system, even the ones that aren't explicitly Reacha based, for some kind of underlining value as a project which is intentional and not just legal.
Great. So you're saying you like the search for the core underlying values.
I would just
exactly.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think y'all know that I very much agree with that project, and I think it's worthwhile. But I would just point out that, like, within this conversation, you don't need to go that far, right? You can say that, like, without interrogating these kind of, like, metaphorical core values, you could recognize that, like, in a very legalistic sense, these things play a part in determining, like, actually how the halacha is applied in a way that, like, is clearly not true for kind of whatever he calls that Anglo-American. Yeah. There's just no like legislation on the book that says, you know, Kofin Almida Stone or like the Bar Metzra or like those things just don't exist, right? In a way that, and obviously like his footnote is like, you know, highlighting kind of like the like Ran and Rashiud Aleph's or like kind of just like the standard conception of halacha as like a corpus of a couple of different types of law that interact with each other in very interesting legalistic ways, like how ritual law impacts whatever we call
you went out. You went like out. That, for a
that's
second.
Trivial, right? And it matters. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's just like obviously matters, right? So that is fair. Well, yeah. Whether or not it's a semantic field, I can't tell you.
So I think the issue is like, do you have to go for these like softer ideas, or could you stay like within the realm of just like the laws by themselves, and say like the law, like I'd be okay saying this shows us something about the halacha's conception of property rights without having to lean into something like achicha and reyecha. See what I'm saying? Like, I think it's totally okay to say that the yoreid shows us that not every boundary crossing is automatically wrong. Couldn't that just show us something about the halacha doesn't think there's any reason to have property rights that make a border trespass prima facie wrong? I don't think that has to, that din has to be explained by this, what he calls the semantic field of achicha, reyecha, v'chule, v'chule.
Yeah, but what about like zenana or kofen or din, like it's on a continuum, right? Like maybe yoreid you don't have to explain like that, but like the other kind of like definitely related fields are premised on that.
Maybe. I wonder, like, even zenana v'zelo chaser, you could just say, like, why should you have a right, like if you're not being harmed, why should you have a right to not let somebody else benefit? It's just a more core conception of, like, what rights you have and when you're considered to have been wrong. Like, why do you have to get into this notion of, like, communitarianism?
Well, like, to use your phrasing tomorrow, I'd be like, his Western Anglo-American cards might be showing. Like, if your default is the Anglo-American conception of property, then you need to view, then the halakhic view seems like radically, whatever, you socialistic or communitarian or something like that.
Yeah.
And right, so it must be that like they focus on that while we focus on the normal stuff.
Right, right, right. Right, exactly. It's like, that's, I think that's a good way of putting it. See, to my mind, like, you don't need to get into any deep social theory, like, you know, communitarianism, social, you know, brotherhood, to explain the halachic dinim. It's sufficient to just say, like, the halacha doesn't think it's, you have this legal right to view every trespasser as a wrongdoer. Right? He's only a wrongdoer insofar as you have some economic disadvantage because of his trespass. Let me motivate this point. Let me motivate this point a little further, actually. If you read on in the piece, he talks about particular explanations for yoreid, right? And I think he quoted, this is an important point. He quoted, I think, wine rib. Let's see. This is on page 176. I'm gonna fast forward to 176, then come back to the yoreid discussion. I thought this is really good back and forth. Okay, so he quotes people that yoreid has to do, I think he quotes this guy, Chanoch Dagan. Chanoch Dagan is an interesting guy. I don't know if anybody ever read, if you've read any of his stuff. He's a professor at Tel Aviv University. You can see there's a whole cottage industry in Israel.
Does he have tenure, though, is the most important question.
Yeah, he's like his director of the Center for Ethics there. He's an interesting guy. I think he did a JSD at Yale.
JSD at Yale is a big Israeli move. The places, and by the way, I just want to say, like, they never help make a minion. They are the most useless Israeli expats.
Great.
But it's definitely, they're big in public law. So all these Israelis pop over and do it.
That's right. I don't know if anyone's watched Diesel. Anybody watched Diesel? So you know it's highly recommended. Cole
has definitely watched Diesel. Yeah, I've watched Diesel. I just want to be clear.
So you know the brother from Belgium, the aggressive Chassid Nachum.
Love that guy.
Right. So me too. So Cole, your comment was the equivalent of his Rishayim Arurim.
Exactly.
Okay. So he quotes Dagan here. As again, saying that the yore difference is explained by the socioeconomic ethos of each legal tradition. Jewish law expresses an ethos of soft communitarianism, which he calls an institutionalized limited altruism. Okay. Which he says derogates, I don't know what that means. Cole, do you know what derogates means?
Hold on, which derogates fragments of entitlements of individuals and the resources that they hold. No, I know what arrogates. I know what a lot of...
Derogates, right, whatever. Only means detracts from or
deviates. Detracts. Okay. That's helpful. So it creates a common pool from which others in the community can utilize. So Dagan's point is that this sense of communitarianism, of achicha, reecha, it makes the property rights softer. I think Porat has a pretty good objection to this. And he says, I thought this was really sharp. This is on page... Yeah. This is on page 176. He says it seems like the altruism only goes one way. Like my rayis, my chazis, that the bala karka should have to be altruistic, right, and have a legal duty to compensate the yored. Why not say lehefich? The yored has an altruistic duty to the bala karka. And we'll say that, oh, he was conferring a benefit on the balakarka. Like, why should the altruism / communitarianism push us towards viewing the balakarka as being chayiv to the yored, rather than viewing the yored as conferring some sort of benefit on the balakarka?
I thought he addressed this in one of the footnotes where he kind of said, well, Dagan actually has like a distributive justice form of this, as in, just like we saw by like the Poel, Ochel Mishal Baal Bayis, the Poel is assumed to be an Ani, and therefore maybe we'll want to like distribute some of this wealth, and there's just one venue of this. So over here, the Yored, the Poel here is assumed to be more disadvantaged. I mean, he has to read all these things as kind of like shoehorn public policy.
Correct.
Halachos.
Correct.
But he has an answer. The asymmetry, is what I'm saying.
That's right. You could also say, yes, that's one argument. It's like, oh, presumably, like between the yored and the balakarka, like the yored is the one who needs the comp more than the balakarka needs the improvement, right? The free improvement. I think another way of putting it is that, like, if you're just looking at it equitably, maybe it's like there's a net, like everyone's taken care of if the balakarka compensates the yored. Right, assuming it's nichale, so like everyone is like the benefits and costs offset each other. Whereas if we're going to view the yored as a volunteer, the yored is going to be in a net negative. Right, so you might just think that there's that equitable consideration. But my point is, and I think Porat's point here kind of undermines his earlier point, which is the more you view this as like an achicha reyacha thing, it's really not so obvious that should imply that property boundaries yield to the labor contribution of the yored, rather than the labor contribution of the yored just yielding because of this achicha thing to the property of the balakarka. And again, Zachary is saying you could finesse it. I get it. To my mind, it's a bit of an open question which way it goes. No, Zachary, do you agree or?
No, I mean, all those psukim are like ki amuch achichas. It is specifically talking about the relationship between a disadvantaged brother and an advantaged person, you know.
I understand, but you're just saying it's an assumption that balakarka is the advantaged person.
This is not...
What's that, Shua?
This is not fully formed, so if nobody can kind of help this along, we could just let it die, but I was talking to Aviezer about this, and he mentioned that he thought that there were a couple of like steachuza sugyos that have like similar like a sugya in Shmuis maybe about kind of like the relationship between property owner and like kind of like previous, or that kind of like track similar conceptions, and that also is so I would have to motivate that connection and look into it and figure it out, because if that's true, that also is clearly like built into kind of these semantic fields of brotherhood and fraternity or whatever, right?
You're saying that there are other genim of bylos that would be explained by the same theory.
Yeah, that fit into kind of the same conception of that, like that we've been developing here. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, it's definitely worthwhile pursuing. If you have any of those things you want to like any particular examples you want to?
I have, like, I've just, like, you sent me a voice and I've just, like, not been able to look them up yet. So that's on me. But
it sounds great. We should definitely look at that.
Yeah, it's fun. But yeah.
Right. Okay, so let's look at the particular argument about Yo raids. This is on page 157. He gives like a nice summary of the Yo raid discussion. He quotes some interesting legal scholars who have pointed to like the Jewish law on Yo raid as like a paradigm for common, like that the common law could learn from in unjust enrichment theories. He says American law would view the improver as a volunteer or as an officious intermeddler. Like, why is this guy in the property altogether? And so, like, American law would never give the Yo raid compensation. In contrast, Jewish law emphasizes the prevention of the owner's enrichment at the improver's expense, right? So he thinks that, like, Yo raid is one of these great examples where just, like, the American system is at a head-on collision with the halachic system. In the American system, the Yo raid would be a volunteer. In the halachic system, the balabayis would be an unjust, would be violating unjust enrichment by benefiting from the Yo raid's work. Now, this is all fine. Again, like his agenda is to set up like this contrast between the systems, as Gabe pointed out. I do want to say that he concedes a lot of cases in American law where they recognize a Yo raid-like principle. To my mind, that's very interesting to show actually the points of contact between the two. Anybody remember the cases that he mentions quickly?
Like Good Samaritan stuff, right?
So yeah, so exactly. He mentions, I'll mention a few of them. He says here, let's see. Yeah, so on page 159, he says, so he sets up the American cases. He quotes this this judge who said, you know, one cleans another's shoes, what can the other do but put them on? Meaning, the Yo raid loses, right? Like, if I polish your shoes for you and now you have nice clean shoes, like, what can you do but benefit from them, you know? Which in the halacha would say, like, I guess you have to pay the guy for the shoe shining. Right, Evan? Is that what you're getting at? Is that what you're smiling?
Yeah, like, the other thing you can do is pay for it. Like, there's two options. You can pay for it or not pay for it.
Right. So the Jewish law answer would be to pay for it. And he's saying like the common law tradition is like, oh yeah, great. Like you lucked out, right? But and then he quotes also like the restatement and all these English law cases that say liabilities are not to be forced on people behind their backs any more than you could confer a benefit upon a man against his will. I'm like, whoa, that's like directly against the Yo raid. Although, remember the formulation of the Rashba and the Radvaz, right? The Radvaz's formulation is like ein chaven es ha'adam bal karcho. So like the Radvaz clearly thought that's consistent with the principles of Yo raid, because like in Yo raid you're presumed to be benefiting. So just it's just important to keep that, you know, how different are these systems. The Rashba also had a formulation along those lines, right? Anybody remember the Rashba's formulation? What was Rashba's formulation? You can pull it up.
In Yachala Kofo, live knows when Toa Bal Korfo, as in about what you can use with the field.
Exactly. So like, you know, in these formulations, the systems actually don't come out as like so radically different. But here's interesting. He acknowledges some cases where the American law comes close to the halacha. So he says, this position is softened in a case of a good faith improver. So like, let's say you improve something where you honestly thought it was your property and it turns out that you weren't. These are like the cases of Yo raid Bershus that we saw, right? Like you bought a property and then you were dispossessed by Dina de Bar Metzra. You bought a property and then Mekachtoa, so you had to give it back, those kinds of cases. Abal Benichse Ishto Shemiana, all those. So here he cites good case in the footnote. An owner who got back his stolen car had to indemnify the good faith buyer who, after buying the car, invested a considerable amount of time in fixing it. So my car is stolen. The Ganav sells it to a third party. The third party puts in like a nice new engine. He puts in new tires and whatnot. In that case, the Anglo-American tradition says you have to compensate. That's a classic case of Yo raid. So you see, so I think that brings that shows a common theme, right? You are forced to pay for the benefit that you didn't request, you're forced to not benefit from somebody else's improvement. I thought that's like a pretty interesting common ground. Shua, you agree? The case of the stolen car?
Sorry, I had a work
right
there. But the idea that there's like common ground between like the unjust enrichment.
Yeah, so like the case of the stolen car you see here in the highlighted footnote. That's like very similar to the O-rate example. Just in the American cases, it's important that you not, like, it was a mistake. Like, you thought it was your car, you improved it, then you could demand compensation from the right owner. Another interesting point of contact is...
But just a... Sorry. One comment on this. To me, maybe I'm influenced by Porat, but I think that those kind of differences, like, actually do highlight a kind of, like, philosophical conception of what property is, in the sense that like we want to protect the inalienability of someone's ownership. And so if there's like reason to think what you're doing is related to your ownership, we're gonna like privilege that. And if there's reason to know that it's not to do with your ownership, we're gonna like disprivilege that. Whereas in halacha, that's clearly not true, right?
Right, meaning, and it's true then, halakhan, even when you know it's somebody else's property, you'll still be entitled to compensation.
Right.
Yeah, so that difference is there. But I'm saying, like, the stronger claim that, like, that it's unique to halakha that you could be obligated to pay for something that you didn't request, right, is undermined by these kinds of examples, right? So, like, there is recognition that you ought not benefit from some contribution that somebody else made to your property, so long as they didn't know it was your property when they made the contribution, right? Let me mention this other exception. So the first case is the mistake exception. The second kind of exception is these rescue cases, which I thought were really interesting. Anybody remember the rescue cases? So he says here, in rescue cases involving an emergency action undertaken by the intervener in order to save his fellow, the intervener is entitled to recovery for his expenditures. I guess like you could imagine all these cases of you're unconscious and somebody spends a lot of money to get you to the hospital to save your life, right? There you're chayiv to pay, even though you never like consented to the service. He says you're chayiv to pay in those cases, which also brings those cases closer to the Jewish law side of things.
The property protection, that's a fair shagamar, right? That's like totally like when the water's coming for your sada.
Yeah,
like that's a exact overlap.
Correct, exactly, we saw this in the Ramban, right? When the Ramban said like, oh, doing an action is like being mashbiach, right? It's like mamona dasa liyade. That's right. So 454 touches on those cases on the American side. Let's see. Well, he says, recently restitution claims of this type have been expanded are now also upheld in regard to protecting property. So I think he has some good cases down here. Yeah, if you look through this footnote 54, it sounds like these cases recognize that a finder who cares for goods that are ultimately returned to their owner is entitled to recovery of the value of his services. In American cases, the finder tends to be entitled to recovery. That's also a case where there's no contract, and yet, like the service that you provide is considered to be mashbiach the bailim, and that entitles you to recovery even under the Anglo system. So I thought all this is really interesting in terms of bringing the two systems closer together. Okay, any thoughts on this before we get into the analysis of the Jewish law side in this presentation? General thoughts? You see, to my mind, the common ground in the emergency cases and in the mistake cases suggests that, like, the nakuda samachlokas here is much more limited. It's really just about the nature of exclusion and property, not about, like, the more fundamental question of, is it reasonable to hold somebody liable for a benefit they receive without requesting the benefit? That's what I think these cases really get at. All right. So he talks about the, Evan, go ahead.
So are you just distinguishing between, like, sort of the consent / reshut and the compensation? That, like, I'm not entirely sure what distinction you're making there.
Yeah. My point is that you might say, like, what's the chiddush of halacha here? What's the chiddush of the yored sugyos? Right? One way to look at it is to say that the notion that you should ever be held liable to pay for a service or a benefit that you didn't request, that's really, like, what's distinct about the halacha's conception. Like, under American Anglo system, you always have to contract for a benefit. You always have to request the benefit. You can't force somebody to pay bal karchem without their consent. And I think, like, these cases show that that's not true, right? The fact that, like, in the emergency case, you have to pay bal karchem. In the case of somebody saving your property, you have to pay bal karchem. You still got to pay. Like, we don't say, oh, you didn't contract for it, you're off the hook. That, to my mind, suggests that the yored issue, like the yored machlokes, is a much narrower question about what presumptions are created by being a landowner, right? In the halacha, like, it's like we don't, like, there's nothing about being a landowner that implies normative fences around, like, your boundary, right? So it's okay for somebody to come in and make an improvement and still be compensated. Whereas in the American system, like, that's trespass, that's a wrong. Nobody should be able to profit from their wrong. So, like, the nakuda samachlokes is, like, specifically about a conception of trespass, not about a broader conception of unjust enrichment or whether all services have to be contracted for. You see that, Evan? Is that clear? Which makes me move away from, like, the achicha, the achva, because, like, we're not explaining something about, like, a broader duties to each other. It's, like, a much more limited issue about karka. Just, like, what are the rights that, like, which sticks, which bundles come along with, like, being, which bundles of sticks come along with being a property owner? And to me, it seems like an open question whether a property owner should have a right to, you know, that nobody be on his property without his consent, or he has a much narrower right that people not interfere with his use of his karka or with his plans without his consent.
But this formulation, like, there's a difference between an inherent right to exclude trespass versus a duty to remunerate for a remunerate. What did I say?
Remunerate, like money.
Remunerate. Oh, remunerate. Okay. So, or, like, you can say, okay, so halacha says that I can't prevent harmless trespass, but that doesn't necessarily follow that the Baal Bayis has to pay the yored.
Right. This is true, but the point is, one could have said that what's unique about the halacha's position is the duty to compensate for an unsolicited benefit. Right, Aden?
Can I say that again?
One could have said that what's distinctive about the halacha is the duty to compensate for an unsolicited benefit.
Yeah.
Right? I'm just pointing out, even in Porat's analysis, he's showing that there are many cases in the, like, Anglo-American tradition where you do have a duty to remunerate for an unsolicited benefit. The case of, like, the stolen car, right?
Mm-hmm.
If somebody bought the car and made improvements, you have to compensate the improver. The case of rescue, somebody, like, saves your stuff or you got to pay the guy. So that can't be what's doctrinally distinct about the halachic system, right? What's doctrinally distinct is, like, the particular conception of property boundaries and whether whether the Yorei did some wrong by being in your property.
Like, I just want to defend Perot for a minute.
I want to defend Perot for a minute before Cole defends Perot for a minute, and then what's the theory? What's the English law, American law theory for compensating in those cases? Because like my intuition is that it's literally like a takanas hashavim type thing, which
I know in Mishpat Ivri this comes up. It comes up in some circuits I teach. I know that in the description of the law in Mishpat Ivri, it's like we want people to be good Samaritans, so we just want to remove any.
It's like specifically, I think, outside of this equation, right? Like, well, maybe not entirely outside, but like orthogonal at least to a point where like I don't think it necessarily reflects on like base level assumptions of ownership.
Right, and Perot even says later on that like things like, you know, your amendment or your other rights could come into play. So just as, you know, safety or stuff like that would come into play here.
What do you mean by that, Evan?
Like there are other factors that could affect the compensation in the protecting property or protecting person case that don't show that it's so close to Yored or to the Jewish conception of Yored.
Where did he say that? You think he said it here? It's interesting. We'd have to look. I think it's an interesting point. We'd have to look into these cases to see why. Shua's saying we have to look at like the underlying theory in these American cases as to why you have to pay. Right, Shua? That's your point? Okay. I would just say that also, remember that the underlying theory in Yored is also underdeveloped. Like we actually, you know, we saw like a views that said it's about the labor mixing of the Yored, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess that does take a clear stand. But you might be open-minded that there might be other explanations for Yored, like Perot himself suggests. But you wanted to get a word in on this?
Me?
Yeah. You're going to be all right.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to say, so there is no, there are like a couple of moral theories in the West, maybe like three when it comes down to it. And there will be no legal system that perfectly embodies any one of them. All will probably incorporate all of them. What that means is that the interesting claim, the interesting thing about like this kind of comparative legal analysis is not whether a particular system makes utilitarian or deontological or aesthetic considerations. It's probably not even where the differences are between the systems, because those differences might not be reducible to they might or might not be reducible to a difference in how much the principle is like taken seriously. There might be other reasons. The most interesting thing for me, at least, is the kind of internal, how does the system weigh these values within itself? And that will shed light on, I think, on what, like, you know, what the legislators or whatever, take seriously. What are the intuitions that tend to win out when there are conflicts? I in general think that comparative analyses are stupid and unilluminating and usually excuses for not doing more serious theoretical work within a particular system. I don't think that systems shed light on each other. I don't even, the causal terminology that's used in these analyses, I don't find helpful.
You're not on board for this kind of project even.
No, I comparative law, comparative anything doesn't strike me as we should try to understand things on their own terms, not on other people's.
Kant used to say that to understand something, you want to contrast it with nearby things. So, you know, this is, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, but anyway, the more important thing is not the point of I just made about comparative analyses. It's the point about how the different ways of drawing these lines about, you know, which principles and communitarian versus libertarian, those will sometimes be reducible to matters of principle. More often, though, the illuminating thing is to see within a system how it understands certain principles winning out over other principles.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So I think Porat does a good job surveying the Sugya. You know, like in his analysis of Yorid, I think he gets like the main stuff out there. Interesting. I think he's good to qualify the Gemara's cases to cases where you know it's the other guy's stuff, cases of irreversibility, and cases of uncontrovertible benefit, meaning there's no machlokas that the Baal Karka actually benefited. And I think that all made a lot of sense, just to, you know. And he said there are two salient areas of dispute between the American and the Jewish side. So he said, for example, over here, yeah. He says there could be two practical differences. So one is the case of irreversible improvements. That's obviously one interesting difference. Under the American system, you wouldn't have to pay. Under the Jewish system, at least according to Nesivis, you would have to pay for the Yorid if it's irreversible. And also the case of Rotza Bikiyumo in the American system, like where you want it, where you like it, Nichale. Nichale cases in the American system, we're going to view the Yorid as a volunteer. But in halacha, we're going to say that you now have to compensate him for the benefit. So then he tries to go a little deeper into like, what's the source of the difference between the systems? So he throws out a few suggestions. Let's see, page 165. I thought this was pretty cool. It's tempting to try to explain the Jewish law approach through a resort to efficiency considerations. Did anybody get traction on that argument? I thought it was pretty cool.
Anti-Levine stuff, right?
I think this is pro-Levine, I want to say.
I thought he was saying that, like, it's just not a compelling, there's...
Oh, Porat not find it compelling.
But... Yeah, Porat didn't find the economic efficiency stuff compelling.
Right, but he said, but there is an argument to say that you have to get in the minds of economists here that, like, you create the incentive structure so that people are incentivized to like make all the improvements that will actually benefit Bali Karka, right? So it's like, we all know people need their walk shoveled, right? But like we could avoid the transaction costs of making people call up a shoveler to do it. So we just say like, you know, a Yorid could recover. So the Yorid will go, he'll do it, he'll recover compensation. People will be incentivized to like make gardens beautiful for other people. So like maybe society will end up in some net positive utility based off the Yorid rule if you set up the incentives and deterrence in the right way. Zachary, is that what you got out of this?
Yeah, I mean, he's moved it to the temptation to explain it as efficiency considerations, but I thought his critique was pretty damning.
Yeah, meaning that it's always better to just defer to the subjective, right? Let the Baal Karka do it for himself, like let him hire services, right?
Yeah, as in how is it more efficient to have random people come work your land than just, you know, have people hired?
Yeah, pretty interesting theory though. I think Rabbi Levine does have that kind of an argument somewhere actually. He doesn't cite Levine, but in one of the books, I think he has this kind of economic theory for Yorid. Maybe I'll make Gabe research that and see if it makes sense. Gabe, did you think about this at all, the economic argument for Yorid?
I arrived at Zachariah's conclusion that Korat raised the Levine-like suggestion and rejected it. But
yeah.
Then I don't find it
compelling. You don't find it compelling, Gabe, is that what you're saying? No. Gabe, did you have thoughts on the piece up to now that you wanted to share? Gabe?
Nothing coherent yet.
Give me a few minutes. Okay. When you have something to share, please share it. The next point that he raises, he cites Weinrib. Weinrib's an interesting thinker. I thought this was really a really interesting idea. It's really just about the different expectations.
Oh, I thought this was totally circular.
Well, it's circular in a certain way. Like, it's not deeply explanatory. But I think what Weinreb is saying, the way I understood this, is that American law, individualism resides in the institution of property. Since the improver knows that the owner is the only person who has the right to determine the future of her property, then improving the owner's property without being asked to do so cannot raise a justified expectation for remuneration. See, I like this. So it's just like, look, if you grow up in America and like you know that like it's like you trespass, you do it at your own risk, you're definitely not going to be able to be compensated for it, then that's like the reasonable rule for the system, right? Like the system is just going to be understood in terms of the expectations created by its other norms. Like the norms in America are that like you don't trespass and do something in somebody else's property. But in halacha, like if that's not a norm, like if there's no entrenched notion of absolute property, then like the expectation could be very different. Like in a system that had a different property rule from the United States. So what I like about Weinreb is that it's very deflationary. It's not saying that there's something like yisodus dik nekudas amachlokas. It's just saying, look, the rules and norms of the system are different. It happens to be that like in America, like nobody could reasonably trespass with the expectation of being remunerated for his services. In halacha, where like the property rules look a little different, it's perfectly reasonable for somebody to think that they could be remunerated for this kind of a service. You see that, Adin?
Yeah, so like I have this on the top of 167. Like he does mention that like on the end of the second paragraph on 166, he says Weinreb's argument therefore highlights the point requiring explanation. Like he's pointing out like,
yeah,
like it needs for, but then he's like on 167, he says, Jewish law by contrast sees the improver's action as legitimate since the owner was not damaged. But the contrary benefited, and since she did not exercise her right to exclude by getting the active right involved, therefore the non-owner does not have to bear the cost of legitimate activity. The improver's expectations for remuneration is considered reasonable and legitimate, and the owner has to indemnify. Be like, but that can't be the reason the Yoreid, the Baal Bayis has to pay. Like you're saying, the Baal Bayis has to pay because the Yoreid expects to be paid since there's a chiyuv for the Baal Bayis to pay.
You're saying that's circular.
Yeah, I thought that was whether or not the, like you're saying that, oh, the expectation is reasonable because the rules set up the expectation to be reasonable.
Well, right. Well, I think what Porat's trying to do at this point is say, why are the expectations different in the systems? Like, why is it like what Weinreb says? Like, why is that true? And his point is that they have different doctrinal approaches. Sorry, because according to American law, the non-owner's exclusion is the default option. In Jewish law, he's a little cryptic about this. The way I think, the best way to make sense of this to my mind is that it boils down to a difference in like the conception of property boundaries, like I was saying before. So like, In a legal system where property boundaries are absolute, so like there are normative fences that you can't cross. So when you cross the fence, you forfeit any right to be compensated for what you do on the other side. Whereas if like halacha doesn't view property as having like those normative fences around it, then, you know, it's an open question, like how much you'll be compensated for the benefit you confer on the bala karka. See, I think that's the right way to go here. I think that's even what Weinreb is trying to say at this point. The question looming in the back of my mind is like, this has nothing to do with like the achva, achicha. Like, I don't think the boundary rule is explained in terms of that. To my mind, as Weinreb says, like it's an open question, like how a system of law is going to formulate property boundaries as like this absolute Blackstonian thing and whatever, or just like, property is where you could generally determine what's done. But, you know, if someone comes into your property and does something, it's still an open question, like what they're entitled to. So like the Nakuda Samachlokas is very, very narrow. right? It's really just like, neither is like more intuitive than the other. Neither is like more obvious than the other. Neither one like needs to be like explained in light of the other one. It's like, we all know there could be different ways of setting up a property rule. Just like there are different percentages that we could hold people obligated for in taxes. And the American rule just sets it up in this very strong way. And the Jewish rule sets it up in a much weaker way.
Yeah, I think my concern, I'm motivated all that, but then the expectation of the improver seems to be entirely trivial then. Like, we're just saying, like look at what the rules are. And if the rules say X, then the rule is X. And if the rules say Y, then the rule is Y. It has no practical effect.
That's exactly right. The expectation, I think this is what Parag's trying to say. He's trying to say the Weinberg point about expectation is just a function of what the underlying property rule is.
Okay.
See, but the point that I want to stress here is that the underlying property rule is not like a grace of chiddush. Like, it's not like there, like, you don't need to come on to Reyecha or Achicha to explain the underlying property rule difference. That's just like a purely open question, like how a system wants to define its property rules. Thick property borders or thin property borders, you know? Gabe, you had a hand on this, and then I think Adam Isaac.
Yeah, just to clarify, you're agreeing with for all of the answers to the what questions, and just not that you don't think the why questions are begged or any you don't accept his answers.
I think so.
You agree with the legal underpinnings of in the Chakir he's drawing, or just not sure that it's worth delving into value system underlying this.
I think so, right. Or to put it slightly differently, I would say like the value system question about property rules is just as much a value question as the value question of Achicha rules. So like, it seems to be an important value question about how you're going to set up property borders. That itself doesn't have to be rooted in a value of Achicha or Vahaptul Recha Kamocha, et cetera, et cetera. Do you hear that, Gabe? Or like, why isn't how we view property itself a fundamental value question? Like, it doesn't have to be grounded in a more fundamental value question. Do you see that, Gabe?
I definitely hear what you're saying. I intuitively don't agree with that, but I need to think more about why. I don't want to spend time on that.
Yeah, we should talk about it. I just want to mention one other possibility here to throw into this mix. Let me just quote one more thing from the article here in 177. It was a good quote. And then we'll end. So on 174 and 177, when he talks about the Zenon of Zelochaser, he says, while the common law sees the mere act of trespassing and benefiting from the owner's property as establishing blah, blah, let's see. Jewish law advocates that this act is insufficient to constitute such a claim. This is in the Zenon of Zelochaser. You're just saying that in the common law, it's the fact that you trespass that's going to make you liable to the balabayas. Whereas Jewish law thinks that there's nothing intrinsically wrong with the trespass unless it's accompanied by a loss suffered by the owner. So I think that was like a very good formulation. And then again, on page 177, he says, according to Anglo-American tradition, any uninvited activity by another person is considered trespass and will require its initiator to bear all associated costs. And an unrequested improver is hence not entitled to remuneration. In Jewish law, on the other hand, when there's no economic justification for excluding a stranger, then the stranger's activity is legitimate by default, and he's not required to bear the costs. You see, that I think boils it down. That boils it down to like a more basic, I think it's a very good formulation right there. Just prima facie, is a trespass considered a wrong? In American law, yes. In Jewish law, you need something more basic. You need some sort of economic setback to make it wrong. And that's just a question of like what you think about trespass itself. But that's really the nekudas machlokas, which I think is a really good way of putting it. Let me just mention as a totally separate point that another way you might look at this, if you're looking at this through like a, almost a modern philosophy, modern political philosophy slash like post-Marx lens, you could say like the question here is just a question of, are we going to side with the capital landowner, like the balakarka, or are we going to side with the person who makes the labor contribution? Like in a Yorade case, right, there's a person who has like the labor contribution, and then there's the person who has the land, like the property contribution. And it's just like an open question, like which one wins out the other, like, or could one survive the other? And you might say that, well, Yorade is just siding, the halacha of Yorade is just siding with the person who makes the labor contribution rather than the person who has the karka contribution. And people disagree, people have different intuitions about this, like which one's considered to be like the, which is the, who has the morally stronger claim as between the two of them, right? So like, if you're a good capitalist, you say, well, it's like my capital that generated it. And that's like equal or stronger contribution than the labor. Or you could say, some people think that labor is like a more fundamental contribution than just supplying the, you know, the capital or the place for the thing. Adam Isaac, we'll give you the last word for today.
Sounds good. Sorry, I was driving back from Staten Island for the past hour and a half. My thoughts are a little jumbled here, but I mean, something that I've been
thinking about. Tends to happen when you spend time in Staten Island.
Exactly. I was just participated in one of the vaccine trials, so we'll see. I don't know if I got the right one. I don't know.
Wait, okay. Have you been participating until now?
No, I just went today, like first time.
Which vaccine trial?
Johnson & Johnson.
Wow.
Yeah.
So right, you only need one, right?
So this is, they're testing to see if like having two makes it better.
Wow.
So we'll see. We will see. But
we don't know. We don't know if you got it or not. Because
yeah, I'll probably, if I get side effects in the next 2 days, then it's probably a good indicator.
Or it's a good indicator of like the reverse placebo effect. No.
Yeah. Very, very strong placebo. Like you really believe it. But something that I was thinking in terms of, in general, there's something very libertarian about Anglo-American law, particularly about American law specifically. And the cases where we see American law actually break and seem to act a little more like Judaic law, I think are good instances of that. For instance, like the case of like your life's in danger, you go to the hospital, that's where law sort of breaks. But American law, theoretically, from libertarian standpoint, like, yeah, we should allow people to take their own lives. But we have something wrong with that. That's where sort of our mindset breaks a bit. We're like, okay, fine. Like, we don't, if you do that, so there needs to be
some
economic realization factor. What?
There are no libertarians in a foxhole.
No libertarians in a foxhole. So conceptions are like that versus in halacha, but probably it's just in standard views of land in general. If you don't have that sort of that super libertarian mindset where everyone could just shoot someone for being on their property, you have a completely different set of values. So this idea that we're trying to find some type of economic manner of finding a solution makes complete sense. There's nothing that seems to be incredibly new or interesting about it.
Yeah, interesting point. All right, so let's stop. We're going to stop here. Sorry for going a little over. Next week, Shomrim, if you have some comments on the Porat piece, on the analysis of Porat, feel free to just, you know, take a few minutes in the beginning of next Chabur to raise them. I know Gabe wants to chew it over the weekend. And we pick up with Shomrim on Tuesday. All right? Shkayach, everyone. Thanks for all the good discussion today. See you all next week. Have a good Shabbos.